Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with J.C. Hall, a hip-hop artist and social worker who runs the Hip-Hop Therapy Studio Program at Mott Haven Community High School, a second chance transfer school in the South Bronx. In 2013, J.C. put together a professional recording studio to provide students the opportunity to engage in the therapeutic process through writing, recording, producing, and performing their own music. The origins of the program are chronicled in the award-winning short documentary Mott Haven, which showcases the effectiveness of this approach for addressing trauma in the wake of a school tragedy. As a result of its impact over the years, JC won a Jefferson Award for Outstanding Public Service in 2020. JC, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So I would love it if you could start by telling us a bit about your personal history and how you thought to weave your work as a social worker with your love for hip hop.
That's a great question. I guess how far back to go? Well, it's, hip hop saved my life. And I mean that very literally. When I was growing up, I struggled a lot as a teen, and hip hop was one of the few lifelines I could really grab onto. You know, particularly in the music, listening to it, I heard artists talking about things that, you know, taboo subjects, things like mental health, addiction, that, you know, it wasn't really okay to talk about, or that people weren't very open about. There's a lot of shame about. And I noticed in these songs, they were just very open, and it made me feel not so alone. So that's what really gravitated me towards the music in the first place. But then actually engaging as an artist and participating and writing, there was something tremendously therapeutic about it. That I didn't know at the time, like that's what it was. I just knew it gave me a reason to get out of bed in the morning. It allowed me to connect with others in a very genuine, real, and raw way. There was never any other medium where I had had that experience. And so I just took to it, and it was a way for me to structure and organize a lot of the madness swirling around in my head and a lot of the things I was going through, and just a way to kind of put it to a time ordered beat, find some order to it. And that was helpful for me. And then I later was introduced to therapy. Initially though, with therapy, I didn't take it very serious. I would lay on my psychiatrist's couch and take a nap. That was pretty much the extent of my experience.
Your rebellious way of engaging in therapy.
Yeah, it was just, you know, like, yeah, 15 years old. I just went and there just wasn't any genuine connection, you know, nothing against him. It just, I don't know. I didn't feel like we had anything to talk about. So fast forward a while through my own journey through recovery and addressing issues and actually getting a solid therapist and really vibing with someone who was an incredible guy, someone I see to this day, who also helped save my life. That I started seeing a lot of these inherent overlaps, what was occurring through engagement in hip hop culture and what was occurring within psychotherapy. I think I knew that on an intuitive level, or at least I acted as if. I might not have known it cognitively, but that's when I had something go on, I immediately went to write. I immediately went to write and record. It was instinctive. And then I stumbled on my late mentor, rest in peace, Dr. Edgar Tyson. I stumbled upon his work, and then that just revolutionized and changed the whole trajectory of my life, because I majored in psych in undergrad and had no interest in going back to school for a master's. But I realized with the bachelor's in psych, there's really not much you could do. The best job I got was delivering pizza, which was a dope job. I could just listen to music all day, ride around and bump. Like, it was great. But I wanted to do something more. And happened to apply back at the one school, you know, at the school I went to, Fordham, for social work. Heard they got a good program. Figured I'll just apply there, hopefully get rejected, because it's a pretty good school. You know, hopefully they'll just, because part of me was like, I still want to be an artist. I want to pursue my own artistry, and I'm selling out if I go back to school and giving up on myself. I get in, and I start having this existential crisis of like, I don't want to be here. What am I doing? And then, but I heard about music therapy. Someone mentioned that. And I was like, oh, great. You know, so I start diving into what is music therapy? How do I get involved? There's a couple programs in the area. And, but I read that you have to know how to sing and play three instruments, like a guitar, piano. Like, so I'm not trained whatsoever musically. So I wouldn't be eligible. So I was super bummed out. A random idea popped in my head. Let me cut out music and put in hip hop in the search bar and see if hip hop therapy is a thing. And I didn't think it would be. And boom, I entered it. And just a whole slew of articles are popping up, like evidence-based research. And this, I just keep seeing this dude's name, Tyson. And I'm like, who is this guy? I need to find this dude and move to wherever he's at and just pick his brain. Like I scoured everything he published. And it turned out he was teaching at the one school that I just applied back to, Fordham. So it was like the school I was about to be starting my program in, the one guy in the world who happens to coin this term and start developing the evidence base happens to be a professor there. So, you know, that's kind of how it all began. It was a series of very, very fortunate events. Had I never stumbled on his work, I don't know if I would have made the connection. Well, the connection was made. I don't know if I would have been encouraged to actually give it a shot, because you say stuff like that in grad school or in the therapeutic community in general, and it's not mainstream. So it's, you know, you kind of have people side eye it, laugh, you know, but having like, yeah, here's this tenured professor who is right. Like is legit and he's saying, no, this is real. That was enough for me to just like off to the races. And bring in my own work as an artist and try to provide those skills to the youth and provide them space to record and create their music how they envision it and how they want it. So, yeah, that was a very long answer to your question.
No, it wasn't.
I don't know. Okay. Yeah,
that was perfect. About, and it, but... Yeah, and it ticked all the things I was hoping that you would talk about, because it really helps provide us with a really good context moving forward before we dive in. And going back kind of to your personal history, I imagine that hip hop and the way that you were relating to the music when you were young also gave you a way to talk about difficult things with other people without talking them about them personally, right? Like, yes. I feel this way. It was when this artist talks about this in this way, I feel, instead of, can we talk about my feelings?
100%. And that's super crucial, I think, initially, right, when developing rapport. And Tyson wrote about this with... Caroline Coben. They have this dope 2006 article. They refer to it as third person self-disclosure, where it's initially when you're listening to a song and you have a way to discuss it at an arm's length, so it's not too personal. It's a nice middle ground where it helps get the foot in the door and begin the conversation, where you can get a gauge of where an individual is and what they believe based upon their responses to the songs that they like or that you bring to the table. And it's a great way to, yeah, to just fight against that shame, that inbuilt shame we all have around it, where it's like, I can't say this, but if I'm speaking about my friend, like my friend has this problem, you know what I mean? My friend has, you know what I mean? Like when it's third person, it becomes a bit easier and helps open the door to then develop that rapport and have that one-on-one direct self-disclosure.
Absolutely. Because everybody, regardless of their backgrounds or experiences, has had a moment where they've come to somebody that they trusted and whose opinion they valued and said something that they were going through and disclosed something tough that they were experiencing and had that person either reject them or shame them for it. That's kind of a universal experience we've all been through, right? Mm. And that those experiences teach us we shouldn't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
When really what it says, you grow and you become older and you have more experiences and more education and you learn that it really says more about them than it does about your experience, right? That you're not okay. It's that they can't hold whatever it is that you're going through. But this third person self-disclosure part, yeah, huge part of that, where you don't have to put the position on the other person of holding something difficult that you're going through, because you're sharing something about your friend.
100%. I think that's a great way to put it. I think it's also a bit of a litmus test in terms of like, can person hold space for me, especially like in terms of cultural relevance, right? Like there might be, you know, a client might come in, see me and off rip before any words spoken, anything. There's the automatic kind of like, chances are he is not going to agree with or view it the same way as I, because we both have lived very different lived experiences based solely on the color of our skin from our socioeconomic background. So to be able to come into a room and be able to see, like, the fact that you're even using it, that you're even bringing it, that this is now even deemed like legitimate enough to bring into right. a therapy session is off rip checking a box in terms of like, okay, I can drop some defenses.
Yeah.
You know, this individual is showing, at least whether they're of it or from it, they're showing a basic respect for it by right. even validating it to bring it into the space. And I think even in that initial approach of just listening to music together and talking about it, there's a lot of that hierarchy, perceived or real, that gets dismantled off of that one very small interaction.
And takes a level of the skepticism out of the picture, so that there's at least a greater level of perceived safety, or they're entertaining the idea that this might be a safe space.
Yeah, whether they think you know, but then you kind of can show, the more you talk about it and engage, then they start to see like, oh, like this person knows what they're talking about, or they have an appreciation for it, or they're involved in the culture in some way. And very quickly, it kind of cuts through a lot of that, those traditional obstructions and just blockages, right? Like even for me, I don't know if it's a class thing or I don't know, but my experience in therapy was very like, it felt like very highbrow, and I felt like I was being spoken down to, you know, a lot of the academic language, and I didn't feel like I could be my authentic self in that space, just based on how the therapists that I've seen where it didn't go well, the way I perceived them. A lot of that was on me and projecting and all that. But the more we can do as therapists to help create a welcoming space and let clients know off rip, like, no, like this is cool here. This is valid. It's very valid, you know, and it's important that you feel comfortable to discuss, you know, in any way your experiences, whether, you know, it might be seen as taboo or shameful or.
Yeah. And we're jumping ahead a bit in my agenda of things I wanted to talk about, but what you said just brings up what I was going to say about how the beautiful thing that I love about kids is that they never want to think their way through stuff. They want to, like, their bodies immediately want to go to like movement or expression, or like we have to actually train kids how to think before they act or think before they express, right? And so the kind of your methodology takes that into account. It's like, we're not going to come in here and, again, like you said, like lay on a couch and be in our brains about thinking about what happened or thinking about what we feel or thinking about what we could have done. We're gonna move, we're gonna write, we're gonna express, we're gonna breathe, we're gonna do all of those elements that kids are already so great at, but we're gonna do it in this different context.
Absolutely. And I think there's nothing wrong with like the lay on a couch approach like that. The cognitive stuff can really be useful. But I think it's even from a neurobiological perspective, right? Like in terms of engagement, you have to kind of be able to meet the client where they are. And especially like what you're saying with kids and youth, right? If maybe it's more comfortable for them to express through dance, through rhythmic language, right? Because you might see rap as just language and think it's cognition, but because it's embedded within rhythm, it's tied into that musical part of us as well, you know? And so it's jumping into freestyling or jumping into just rapping or making a beat. It's a way to, not only for it to be more engaging in a developmentally appropriate way, it can be a very grounding experience, kind of can calm down the central nervous system, and then build up to those more cognitive levels, right? Like, so sometimes in therapy, especially for youth who have experienced a very large degree of trauma, to come in and attack from the higher order you know, cognitive aspect of it, is often just banging your head up against a wall. And it's not that you can't do that. You know what I mean?
Right. It's just maybe it's just meeting not the them first place. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and working your way up. And, yeah, Kathy Malchiotti, she calls it, I like the way she phrased it. It's like, it's a top down and bottom up approach, brain wise and body based. That's the terminology she uses. I really like that because, yeah, it's not necessarily about one being better or greater than the other. It's just kind of knowing when and or at what level maybe the individual you're working with is at to try to meet them there to build up or to build down. Some people are very cognitive, but they're not embodied at all. They could sit and recount the exact traumatic experience to you, but it sounds like they're doing a job interview. Like there's zero emotional connection, you know? So sometimes working down and trying to get someone really embedded and back in their body and feeling is huge, you know, is yeah. a big part of the work.
Absolutely. And I love that you name dropped Kathy. I actually just interviewed Kathy last week.
Did you?
Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah.
So she's
fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And she also, she talks about the, oh, now I'm going to blank on it, but basically the circle of capability and yeah. being able to like expand the sphere of capability of what you're capable of. So, and having difficult or kind of like exposure therapy, but in just little increments here and there so that what we can tolerate and how we build resilience is by increasing that sphere of capability.
Yes. And slowly, right? Like slowly yes, kind of dipping slowly. Your toes in and working out, you know, like not jumping in, you know, but yeah, dip a toe in. Okay. It's warm, you know, and slowly building out in all aspects. In, I think also in that conceptualization, if I have it right, she talks a lot about, it's not just, kind of confronting the trauma as much as like, or getting over the negative. It's like developing ourselves fully as human beings and expanding upon those positives and finding life purpose and how all of that, you know, is really Absolutely. Built within therapy as well, even though kind of traditionally people might kind of just think in terms of psychopathology and just, oh no, diagnosis this negative. It's like, it's much bigger, broader and than that. And it's important to keep that in mind. And I think that also kind of applies to her conceptualization of that circle.
Absolutely. I want to circle back a little bit so that we give people kind of a better context of your, I didn't even, it wasn't on purpose. I wish I could be like, yes, you see what I just did. Sometimes that happens, not you, but most of the time it's an accident.
It's magic.
Yeah, all intentional. If you could tell me a little bit about your school, set the context for us. We have a really international audience that comes to the trauma conference. And so kind of set the context for me. Where is your school? What's the makeup of the school? What are the kind of experiences that the youth that you're taking through this program, what are they having? That kind of thing.
Got you. Yeah, so I work at Mott Haven Community High School. It's a transfer high school in the South Bronx. So it's a public school for youth who are overaged and undercredited. So between ages 16 and 21 in New York State, you have until 21 to earn your high school diploma, or else you age out and then pursue a GED or what's now a HSE. So yeah, it's youth who have kind of slipped through the cracks of traditional public school systems, often because schools aren't necessarily built with mental health at the top of the priority. It's not taken into consideration to the extent, generally speaking, that I believe it should be, especially understanding Agreed. The correlation between academic achievement and mental health and mental wellness. But yeah, like even having therapists in school, like imagine that was a normal thing, you know what I mean? And a regular thing. And, you know, yeah, slowly but surely, you know, eventually, hopefully. But yeah, there's definitely lacking. And I think what ends up happening is some kids who might be experiencing or showing maybe certain behavioral problems or attention issues are kind of getting slipping behind and getting pushed aside. And the disadvantage accumulates, right? So by the time, you know, they're in high school and it's like a lot of them just stop going, you know, cause it's like, and so they end up at our school as a second chance and, kind of a last resort before being like, all right, I'll just go get a GED. And it provides the opportunity to gain credits at a faster rate. So you can gain more credits a year and hopefully catch up to your cohort and graduate on time. Even if it's not on time, graduate before you age out at 21. So you can get more credits per year. So yeah, I built a recording studio in the school back in 2013. It all started very organically. I started there as an intern. With a laptop, just playing beats and rapping with kids in the back room, and the administration started noticing, like, these kids who normally
people wanted to hang out in your room and you're reaching them, and
100%. And like kids who normally they couldn't even get to show up to school now are not only showing up, we can't get them to leave the building. So they were like, something's going on here. And then, you know, them advocating and saying, like, you know, talking about a studio and like, can we get a mic? Can we get this? And then, eventually just getting like a once in a lifetime opportunity of a budget to build a very professional grade studio for the kids. That was 2013 and just been going strong ever since. And it's been incredible, you know, just having the opportunity to work with them to record, to make beats, and perform as well. The performance piece is big as well, like getting on a stage in front of their peers and their family and telling their stories, recounting their narratives. So a lot of the youth, generally speaking, so the South Bronx is the poorest congressional district in the country. 49% of kids live below the federal poverty line. So we have a very high rate of youth who are living below. It's higher than the 1 in 2. So youth who are socioeconomically disadvantaged, homelessness, teen pregnancy, parents not in the picture, parents locked up, parents addicted to substances, all kinds of stuff with that stemming from the home, right? But then also a tremendous amount of gang violence, gun violence, and being exposed to that, participating in that, and all of those things kind of creating this, Dr. Vanderkolk conceptualizes, right? The idea of developmental trauma, right? Like, complex trauma, but for children from a very young age, just exposed consistently. There was this dope study in Atlanta that showed that a lot of people had living in inner city neighborhoods exposed to neighborhood violence or experiencing rates of PTSD at higher rates than war veterans coming home. So this stuff is very real. And then PTSD, right, being the single event, but complex, like, this is ongoing. And when I'm working with a lot of these youth, it's not like these things have stopped. It's not like they're processing a past event. These are current, you know what I mean? It can be particularly challenging, because there's only so much any single one of us can do, you know what I mean? But I think to start, just providing a safe space for them to come and just start to process on some of that in an individual context, but also in a group context where there's kind of that peer support, I think is a beautiful thing.
And going back to something that you said just a little bit earlier about, kind of how some of these youth get kind of left behind. And I know that one of the things that I've been trying to work on and with my own kids and also in their school system is the idea that every behavior is something a child is trying to communicate, right? Mm. And so often in school systems, and you can speak to this as well, that what the focus is on trying to get a child to change a behavior instead of getting really curious about what the behavior is trying to communicate about either the child, the way the child fits in the classroom or in the school, what's happening in the child's home, right? And schools are just not equipped, like you said, to go to that deep level of understanding. And so what happens is because we can't deal with and help with what the behavior is trying to communicate, the children get removed from the classes so that they're not an obstruction to everybody else's learning. I mean, is that fair? Yeah.
Very, very well put. No, spot on. Yeah, like the focus being primarily attenuating behavioral issues and just trying to clamp down on that, and then, you know, putting a band-aid on the cancer and then like all right, if that stops, right, it's okay. But what was really underneath all that? And then there's also the quiet kids slip through the cracks, the ones who maybe are more dissociative and are more quiet and aren't the ones throwing desks at teachers and, right, and breaking windows. And, you know, it, just because they're quiet and aren't causing trouble doesn't mean they don't need services. But unfortunately, those are the kids who slip through the cracks.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we all know that, you know, there's outward expressing people that are just naturally like, I'm going to express outward. And then there's people that retreat inward. We're split down the middle in my household. So I totally understand that. Right?
Got you.
And yeah, so I absolutely hear you when you say that the quiet ones as well are dealing with, there's a whole storm going on inside there.
Absolutely.
And we share the same dream that there would be social workers and therapists at every school in the country for sure. Mm-hmm. I hope someday that's the case.
Same.
So I want to talk a little bit about the power of narrative, because we know so much about narrative and how does narrative fit into hip hop, and what you're doing with the people that come into the studio. How is that giving them a tool when they are out of your studio, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, the narrative piece is huge. And the thing about hip hop, right, and emceeing is it's a narrative art. It's a storytelling art form. It's born out of a tradition like the West African griots, right, like these traveling poets and orators. It's very much, and then, you know, the African American tradition of like signifying and boasting and toasting. It's born out of these very deeply rooted traditions that are narrative based, you know, kind of this beginning, middle, end type thing, right? So there's kind of a hero's journey embedded within the structure itself. And most, you know, hip hop songs that kind of have canon at this point, right, and have the greatest longevity are kind of telling stories and following these narrative structures and kind of the descent into the underworld and then rising up and finding some sort of lesson in that, you know, and then being able to disperse it to the community. That's a lot of that is an undercurrent in hip hop. And it's just built within it. And I think narrative therapy is a huge overlap with hip hop therapy in that sense. Especially it's a very like culturally relevant form of it, right? Like it's one thing maybe to have youth sit and write it out, you know, but if rapping is what they like and what they like to do, then it's just a much more tailored approach for them to, you know, apply those same principles, tell a story through the rhymes and kind of maybe reconceptualize their circumstances or where they're at and their trajectories and where they want to go, you know, be through a culturally relevant medium, something that they've grown up with, that they cherish. And then, in terms of trauma work, I was saying this with Kathy the other day, there's a lot of overlap with Judith Herman and her three stages of recovery from trauma. The idea of first establishing safety, right, which rhythm is very useful for doing, whether it's through the music, through the movement, the bopping, the rhythm built within the words themselves, built within the poetic meter of it. Then you have the telling the story, right? The retelling, that's the stage two, which you're doing in a rhyme. You know, you're doing that in a rhyme. You're telling your experience, right? And then the third one is the connecting, reconnecting with others in society. And that kind of occurs in the telling and in the performance piece. There's something tremendously empowering about sharing in front of a group of peers, something you've been through and how much stronger you are because of it. Something that maybe you were so ashamed of, you never would have told a single person about prior, but now it's at a point where you're utilizing this as a source of strength as opposed to a source of shame. And I think the impact of something like that, and even in my own personal experience with things that I air out in my own music, like the impact cannot be underestimated. That's like bringing those secrets to light, those secrets that keep you sick, so to speak, right? And getting applauded for it, you know, can be tremendously, tremendously empowering, validating, and a way to not necessarily, it's not like it never happened. It's not like the trauma never happened or it's never going to happen again. But at the very least, to confront it. You know what I mean? And you know, to make it hold a lot less of that emotional weight, where maybe the thought of it doesn't immediately send you into a downward spiral. You know, now there's another cognition that you can kind of link with it, a more positive kind of, yeah, but that made me this. It doesn't make it okay, but I got this from that, you know, which is kind of, I guess, the essence of the hero's journey, or the, you know, a narrative approach.
And I also imagined that there's definitely examples of where not only are they getting applauded, but, and this, you can speak to this as well, but where even beyond just applause is like thanks and gratitude of like, what you said helped me realize that I wasn't alone, that I wasn't abnormal, that that other people had shared experiences that I had, especially around even specific incidences at the school, or that people in the neighborhood have experienced, where they're like, I didn't realize I needed your words and your music to help me feel what I had been through about that thing.
Absolutely. And I think that's like, that's the biggest piece, especially from peers, right? Like, it's one thing for me to applaud them and say like, hey, great job, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm not going home to the same neighborhood they're coming from. But now a group of their peers coming up, and there's just so many instances that I can think of, you know, where an individual shared something, and after the showcase or after they heard the song, the MP3, people are coming up to them, people that, you know, they maybe weren't associating with before or weren't necessarily friendly, coming up and saying like, hey, hearing you talk about that, that really, really just struck a tone to me and was more helpful than I could ever express, you know, which is kind of what hip hop was to me, what attracted me to it. Like, that's inherently happening with it. There's something about shedding light and airing out your dirty laundry. And then the way the community comes around it, because at the end of the day, like, there's someone else who's experienced that very likely, you know, and I think the support from that is encouraging. Then they're kind of like,
yeah,
oh, I was super nervous about sharing that. And then, oh, I just had five people come up to me and say, I've been through the same thing. Thank you for having the courage to stand up there and talk about it.
Yeah.
You're inspiring me to talk about it or to make a change in my life. You hear something like that once and it's game over. Like, it's, all right, that's, you know what I mean? Like, that is so enlivening. And it's a beautiful thing, and it encourages them to keep going, you know?
And I'm sure takes something that's super personal and vulnerable and makes it a tool for helping other people. Like, it brings them from just being about them to being about a bunch of other people that they can positively impact or relate to and resonate with.
Absolutely. And that's stage three, right? Like, the reconnecting with society. And I think there's something, this author Akin Yella has a dope piece about this. There's something within African storytelling traditions where the emphasis is very much on the storyteller and the witness cannot exist without the other. The witness holds as important of a role as the storyteller. So it's not just preaching out into a void, right? And creating that kind of communal relationship and dialogue. And that's, you can see it in hip hop in the call and response element, right? Like, the very kind of give and take. Like, when I say, hey, you say, oh, like that very give and take, going off of each other, feeding off each other. And that's very reflective of how groups of people work in general, right? So it's very symbolic in that sense. And I think that can be very encouraging, and maybe people who are traditionally more antisocial, that's the wrong word, but not you know, maybe more shy or not as likely to approach people. Now it's like a moment where you can kind of see like, oh, this, you know, this is bigger than that. It's bigger than just the music. It's bigger than just the performance. There's something underneath all this that can be replicated and brought out into the real world, quote unquote, when I leave here.
And that's, you brought up something else I wanted to say, which is that for those shy kids, that once in that performance element, I know I did an exercise with a bunch of kids in Northern India a few years ago, college students, and where they had to kind of do a performance. And the way that brought them together way more deeply, because they said, you know, this person's super quiet and I thought they were a snob. I thought that they hated all of us, right? Like, it tore down all the assumptions that they had about one another, about what they thought of each other or what their stories were, or what their stories, how their stories built who they were and what was important to them. It just tore it all down.
Great. That's a great point. Very, very, very important point. And because we need each other, you know what I mean? Community, I think, is the essence of community is the essence of a lot of healing, at least, you know, from my social worker, you know, systems kind of lens. It's very much, just community is essential. And especially if it's something that's going to last after treatment is over, after the, you know, the relationship, the therapeutic relationship ends, now they're able to kind of, it's lessons taken with them. And I think that occurs as well, like with the rapping and finding a way to, because great art, right? A great rap is finding a way to articulate yourself. And it's not just to say it with a monotone. Yeah, I was walking down the street and then I saw, it's to really like engage and perform. It's like the art of elocution, right? And those are skills that you're practicing in the booth that are then transferable into real world, whether it's a job setting, making friends, going on dates, whatever it is that, you know, involves any sort of social interaction. So it's like a culturally relevant way to dive into some of these essential life skills in general. But even in terms of you know, things like mindfulness or meditation or breathing techniques, right? Those would be very hard to sell to the youth that I work with. If I'm sitting them down and I'm like, all right, sit and breathe, you know, but if now I'm speaking to them about, when you breathe in your diaphragm, you can get a lot more words off. You can open up your vocal cords and hit certain tones, hit certain notes. So now it's developing a relationship with, okay, when am I breathing in my belly versus when am I breathing in my chest? And being able to notice, right? And then now it's like, it's the same skill. It's tailored to something that they're actually interested and want to do, right? Or same with mindfulness. Describe the street to me, describe this person to me. Don't just say this person, this, like, just give me something tangible. What are they wearing? What does it smell like? What do you see? You know, you can really effective creative writing is calling on the senses. It takes the listener and puts them right where you are. And essentially that's mindfulness, right? Being aware, being centered, being aware of exactly what's occurring, taking in little details. So kind of, again, transferable skills in the realm of healing. And yeah, it's a great way to present it or to even introduce the concept in a way that it's relevant to something they are trying to accomplish or something they hold important, you know? And it's because it's all the same stuff. It's just like in different clothing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I imagine once they've got that practice down as well, As you start practicing something like that, then as you're walking through the street, your mindfulness actually, like, you're walking through your neighborhood or you're walking to school or wherever you go, your mindfulness increases because you're subtly, you know, that you're looking for, like, well, what's the light like today? And what's so-and-so on the corner doing and wearing? And what is the intonation of their voice? And do I hear birds? Is there snow crunching under my feet? Like, they're actually more aware because they're subtly kind of like subconsciously collecting information for further expression later.
Absolutely. And then and then you can even branch into the mindfulness and discuss deep breathing, and, you know, because now you're familiar with the breathing techniques necessary for an effective vocal performance. Now when we're going to perform and get on a stage or even just in a booth, right? Like, all right, but also that can calm you, that can slow down your heart rate, that can help center you, feel that, you know what I mean? And now it's like, oh, okay. That
and
actually works.
I was even going to say, like, now I've got a process to go from, like, super activated, like something has just happened. Now I have the process. I know what to do. I know I can write about it. I know I can talk to somebody about it. I know that I can, you know, I've got a beat that I can put, either my friend's doing it or I'm going to make it myself. I'm going to record it on my phone. And then I'm going to, like, transition that narrative into an expression. Like, I've got a process now that I have agency around.
Absolutely. And I think it's something they've intuitively been doing for a long time. And just like I was, and like the people who first birthed hip hop, right? It was kind of this intuitive thing where even if it didn't have the name on it, therapy or healing or wellness, it was an expression of that. It was an outgrowth of trauma. It was a, you know, form of post-traumatic growth. And I think all I'm trying to do in the work with them is to help provide some skills to help further enhance what they're really already doing, and provide opportunities to further explore that. Cause it's kind of one thing to be able to write and rap amongst your friends, right? But now you want to, it's a whole nother experience to record that on a mic. And then it's a whole nother experience to put that song out if that's what you want to do. A whole nother to get on a stage. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of opportunities that can further amplify this inherent therapeutic right. effect that we're already inherently getting by engaging in the art. But I think,
and
you know,
further like test and practice your ability to hold all that and sit with the agitation that might come up at those various levels of expression and vulnerability.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think when you understand what's going on behind the scenes within your body more, it only can make it a more effective tool.
Absolutely. All right. So if you were talking to, you know, we have a really varied audience of attendees at the conference, you know, practitioners, parents, teachers, physicians, and if you're talking to them at home, what are the like simple things that you would tell them to incorporate into their interaction with kids, with youth? That can take these principles and apply them to how they're kind of interacting with kids?
It's a great question. I would say meet them where they're at. So even if you're not a therapist, or even say a parent, for example, as parents, or even as like, I feel like each generation, parents are always, when parents were growing up, they were always told their music was not good music. It was bad music. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then like the parents, then the children then become the parents and perpetuate the same thing.
Say the same thing.
You know what I mean? And it's like generationally, that's just how it goes. And I think maybe trying to stop that in your own person, like just take a second. You might not like the music. You might not relate with it. You might not even understand it. But if your child or someone you care about that you're working with is resonating with that, it's your responsibility to try to understand and appreciate why. And the majority of that is going to be you simply asking, you know, like even for me growing up on hip hop, there's a lot of new music I don't know anything about. These kids are constantly bringing in songs. Sometimes I can't even make out the words, and I need to ask them, like, tell me what's being said. What about it is touching you? What's drawing you to it? And maybe it's just the beat and that's cool. You know what yeah. I mean? But maybe there's a certain line where it's, you know, so really asking, because we can make a lot of assumptions and it's easy to just assume, oh, if they're listening to that kind of music or they're, you know, when maybe it might just be, I just like the beat. I don't care. I don't agree with what the person's saying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or there's lines in it that are speaking truths to them in a way that they haven't been able to articulate, and trying to ask them to try to articulate how exactly, you know, are you identifying with that? And yeah, not, you know, trying to like even the playing field a little bit, like just level the playing field a bit, try to meet them on their own turf, let them be the expert for a moment. You know what I mean? It's even just once, like, you know, and I think that's, you can still show us that you're a source of expertise and that you have certain knowledge about certain stuff, but it's definitely important at times to like take off the expert hat and just right. sit back and ask, you know what I mean? Because that's tremendously inviting, and also just lets whoever you're speaking with, child, client, whatever, that you care what they have to say, and
exactly,
you're willing
right.
to really listen. Yeah.
Because the goal isn't that you agree with the music or that yeah. you even like the music.
Yeah.
It's that you express that you want to understand why they do.
Absolutely.
What it is about the music that is so resonant with them. yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Cause the thing, right? Like when people used to tell me like, oh, rap, that's not real music. That's this or that's that. I identify, and teens especially, right, are like this. We identify with genres of music, like whole styles of dress and fashion and movement, or like punk, the punk stuff, the, you know, like it's all teens embed so much of their identity within what they're listening to. So when you tell someone that their music is not good, you're telling them they are not good. That's how it's perceived.
That's how they hear it. Yeah.
Yes. You know, and then that just shuts off all communication. Cause why would I want to listen to someone who's telling me they don't, you know, or just is defeating and makes them not even want to try to stand up for themselves and advocate for, no, this is why it's good music. You know,
I think we can all say, especially now that we're, you know, the two of us are adults. Yeah. And I can tell you, I'm not listening to the same albums that I was listening to in high school, right?
No.
Like, we grow, our experiences grow, and we change. And it's just that this music is helping me at this particular place, you know, feel and get a voice and feel the emotions that are important to me right now about this place in my life, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, that more generalized use of hip hop for healing. And if anyone else is interested in that, like non-clinicians, I would recommend Dr. Raphael Travis is a G. He wrote the book, The Healing Power of Hip Hop. And he talks about kind of a spectrum of mental health strategies, right? Where you kind of have self-care, which is what's occurring when we're listening to the music ourselves, and moving into prevention, early intervention, treatment, longer term care. And I think it's a very important conceptualization because, you know, sometimes people could be like, oh, I'm not a therapist, so this doesn't apply to me. Or right. I'm not, or I am a therapist, so this doesn't apply to me, whatever.
Right.
I think it's important to know there's different levels of engagement, even on an individual level, and that hip hop intersects at every single level. So you can get in where you fit in, like whatever is applicable to you, utilizing hip hop culture, if that's what resonates with whoever you're working with, is a very important tool, I would say, to have in your toolkit, especially like, you know, hip hop is, I believe, like the number one genre globally now. I mean, it's, a lot of people, whether you identify with it or grew up with it or not, a lot of people are identifying with it, and globally, not just in the US, like this is, they're breakdancing. And I mean, now it's going to be in the Olympics, the next Olympics. They're tagging up walls in Seoul, El Salvador. I mean, it's all over. It's there's something within it that is speaking to the human spirit and the human experience. In a way that maybe other things are not, right? But the fact that it's even doing that, it just highlights it as such a crucial tool that we all could be using that I think has been overlooked for far too long.
What a great way to end. JC Hall, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. How can people find out more about you and your work?
I would say to check out hiphoptherapy.com. It's just a site I made for my late mentor, Dr. Tyson. Check out his work. Just such a awesome dude and a brilliant clinician, researcher, practitioner. I would check out Mott Haven. Let's see, what side are we on? If you want to kind of see what some of this work looks like in action, it's a short documentary. A new one should be coming out soon called Haven in the Booth. It was shot right before the pandemic set in. Really excited about that because I think it gives people an opportunity to kind of see this more theoretical stuff in practice and really see what it looks like. And my hope is that that's useful for people in terms of trying to replicate or do something similar. Hiphoptherapy.com. And if you're interested to find me on socials, if you do Instagram and all that, I'm at Phoenix NY. So FIENYXNY. I spell Phoenix a little weird, but that's my artist name. And yeah, you can DM me there, email me at hiphoptherapy.com. Either or, I'm definitely open to building and connecting and would love to hear from all of you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I can't wait to see the follow-up documentary.
Dope. Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity, for real.